Welcome for our oral argument. The Senate, people who are participating in the Senate Scholar Program. And if they would all stand, we'd appreciate that. You may be seated. I've seen you wandering around the building at night. I shouldn't say wandering around the building. You were committed to a purpose as you walked through the building. And our agenda for today's hearing has been changed so that we do not have scheduled a second argument after this. And you all were supposed to come to the second oral argument rather than the first. So we appreciate your willingness to change your schedule and join us for this argument. And after this argument, Justice Prosser will meet with you and discuss the procedures of the court, but not discuss the substantive issues of the case that are that's involved. And on behalf of the court, we want to welcome you and to the Capitol. And say that you're just part of a wonderful program that allows you to learn firsthand the operations of state government. And the court system is delighted to be able to participate in that program through Justice Prosser. With those comments, let me introduce the... how did we find you last night in joint finance?
A man back there.
Did he find you? Well, it was open. The building was open last night until way past 1 o'clock in the morning, and with joint finance, so I figured you probably found through that if you were observing. What Governor, what time did they finish? Capitol Police estimated it about that they would finish about after 2. What time did they finish? Well, they were wrong. What time did you people leave? Okay, well, all right, stay awake now. Let me introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Annette Seeger. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, whom you know and whom you will get to know better. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinson. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions, we will now call our first in a case, 07AP2935D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Jeffrey, is it Wrights or Reeds?
Wrights.
Arguing on behalf of Mr. Wrights is Mark Kent.
Good morning. My name is Mark Kent. I'm an attorney, sole proprietor, sole practitioner out of Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. I represent the respondent appellant, Mr. Wrights, who's also an attorney out of Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. May it please the court. The main focus of this argument is that the 4-month suspension is excessive. We believe that a lesser sanction, a shorter period of suspension would be more appropriate, or a private or public reprimand. We believe this for a number of reasons. Initially, the behavior of Mr. Wrights, the violations, are the result of negligence. He did not intentionally violate the Supreme Court rules, and in particular, we're speaking about Rule 20, :1.15 B. I don't know if you say the colon, but I don't know any other way to differentiate that. The violations are technical violations of the rule. They're not violations involving dishonesty, deceit, or the conversion of funds, as many of the cases that have been cited in OLR's brief are. Again, it was basically a technical violation, a letter of the law type of a violation, but there was no deceit, no conversion of funds, and certainly no client's money was taken, as again is the case in many cases.
Counsel, oftentimes this court deals with what I call progressive discipline. Just like the students might be familiar with, you know, do it once, and then you do it twice, tougher response, do it three times, it's even a tougher response. That's what I mean by progressive discipline. Now, your client has previously been disciplined, and if I recall correctly, was suspended for 5 months. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What, if any, consideration should we give to his prior discipline record in assessing the appropriate discipline today?
I think it's clearly important, Justice Bradley, to recognize that he has been previously disciplined. But under the circumstances of this case, with these facts, I don't believe another suspension for a period of time, especially for 4 months, is appropriate. I know that's taken into consideration in all of the cases. But again, under these circumstances, I don't think it's appropriate to have a progressive type of suspension. Again, mainly because, and I've read a number of the cases cited by Mr. Crone, as well as the ones that that the appellant has cited, and I think all of them that I read pertain to dishonesty, deceit, conversion of client funds, signing checks not made out to you, taking clients' funds out of trust accounts, receiving checks for private investigator and keeping those. None of that occurred here. This is a dispute with a chiropractor, basically.
And wasn't there an issue of deceit towards the chiropractor? If they're getting the money that was supposed to go pay the chiropractor, and then your client doesn't tell the chiropractor they have the money, you repeated several times that it doesn't involve deceit, and you throw that in with conversion, and the lack of conversion seems to comport with the record. But isn't there an element of deceit here?
Well, Justice Gableman, the fact of the matter is there was disputes with this chiropractor about the legitimate amount of his fees. He filed liens in many cases, and my understanding of the facts are that the liens were up front. At the inception of the case, the client went to this chiropractor, Daniels. Daniels immediately would have the firm and the client sign a lien for whatever the fees were, without ever knowing what his fees were going to be. Subsequently, these cases over the years were handled, and in some instances, for example, the total settlement, well, let me say this, chiropractor Daniel's fees exceeded the total settlement for the case. So in that instance, they couldn't possibly, this the firm, and that's Mr. Mandelman and Mr. Wright, couldn't possibly have paid the chiropractor his entire fee. So a negotiation had to take place. So, and in every instance, a negotiation did take place. I think that's uncontroverted in the record. It was an oral negotiation, and again, in the great majority of cases, in fact, in all the cases, it was Mr. Mandelman who negotiated the ultimate payment to Dr. Daniels. But there was never an attempt to avoid his payments. It was always a matter of trying to negotiate the payment to something that the client could live with. Because ultimately, in these personal injury actions, if you pay Dr. Daniels more than he's entitled to, the client is the person who loses the money. So you have this conflict between the interests of the client and the interests of Dr. Daniels.
Did Attorney Reitz or Attorney Mandelman ever sign any type of an agreement with any of the chiropractors agreeing that they would honor their liens?
Well, it's one chiropractor, Justice Roberts.
Okay, Daniels.
Daniels.
Okay. Did they ever sign any kind of an agreement with him saying that they would honor his lien?
I think that these liens were signed by the lawyers. Mr. Wrights, I think, signed only a couple of them.
Well, I think it's to me, it's an important question because of our decision in Jorgen versus Durkin. And no one talked about that in the briefs, which I thought was kind of interesting because it was a suit by a chiropractor against a lawyer who didn't honor a lien that the lawyer knew about. And our court did not hold the lawyer to honoring the lien because the lawyer didn't sign the document. And that's why I asked you the question, because I looked through what I'd been presented with and I couldn't determine whether Mr. Reitz or Mr. Mandelman bound themselves personally to honor the lien.
I'm not sure that the liens are part of the record.
I didn't see them. I just looked again.
Here's a question I had. But again, the way I understand the facts, again, Dr. Daniels would have a client sign a lien and possibly have the lawyer sign the lien at the inception of the claim.
That's very much like Jorgen versus Durkin. That's exactly what the chiropractor, Dr. Jorgen, did in that case. But when it was brought to us, because the attorney would not honor those liens of which the attorney was well aware, we were very persuaded by the fact that the attorney had not agreed in writing to be bound by those liens, even though we knew about them. And that's why I was wondering, did your client sign the liens? That was the genesis of my question.
It's a fact I did not find readily available in the record.
Okay, thank you. That's a fair. Well, the complaint said that he had. Now, the complaint may not be right, but that was the complaint said that the attorney.
And it may be in a couple of occasions he did sign them, but I, again...
The ORR complaint alleged that 15 cases, the client and attorney Mandelman, and they were partners, signed a doctor's lien. In 15 cases, the firm received a settlement, but failed to send written notice of that settlement to Daniels. Mandelman and Wrights, shared responsibility with respect to the cases, but the referee found that Wrights was primarily responsible for preparing settlement breakdowns and distributing settlement proceeds. So we can look at the complaint and see what your answer was, as well as what the referee found. Okay.
Again, getting back to the argument on the rule is a rule that it's not in existence at the present time, but at the time of these violations in 99 and 2000, it basically stated that the lawyer was to give prompt notice to any third party who was entitled to the proceeds and then also promptly paid to the third person the amount he was entitled to. Mr. Wright stipulated that he basically violated the first part of that rule, that is, that he did not give written notice to these persons. Again, the record is clear that there was always oral notice to Dr. Daniels.
Mr. Kent, let me ask you something, and I probably should know this, but I'm just not clear in my own mind about this. Was there some kind of an arrangement with the chiropractor that this law firm would refer clients to him for evaluation and treatment?
This was a long-standing relationship, in particular between Michael Mandelman and Dr. Daniels. The testimony at the hearing, the record shows that Mr. Wrights testified that for some 5, 6, or 7 years before he joined this firm in 1999, Mike Mandelman had this relationship with Dr. Daniels, whereby Dr. Daniels would refer clients to the Mandelman Law Firm, and vice versa. Mandelman would also refer clients for treatment to Dr. Daniels. This was a long-standing relationship between Mandelman and Daniels that Mr. Reitz joined in on in 99 when he joined the firm. And many of the files that we're speaking about, many of the clients' cases, were files of the office when Mr. Reitz joined. So these liens were all signed by Mandelman in advance of Mr. Reitz joining the firm.
Counsel, I think two of the liens were signed by Mr. Reitz, at least that's what the record is.
The great majority were with Mandelman. I was just explaining that prior relationship. Mr. Reitz, I believe, did sign two of the liens in the workers' comp cases, as I refer, which were, I'm going to mangle this name, it's Zylkowski, and then I believe Reynolds is the other workers' comp case.
Well, should we be at all troubled by that type of an arrangement, do you think?
That's not a violation that has been charged against Mr. Reitz. Personally, I think it's a troublesome relationship in the setup that you are agreeing. I think the lien setup, signing a lien in the beginning before you have any idea what the fees are going to be, is, again, it creates this natural conflict in my view between client and doctor, because again, if you pay the doctor, you're not, every dollar that goes to the doctor is not going to go to the client. I think it's a regular practice by lawyers. I think they have this type of a relationship. They find somebody who is good for their clients, is willing to treat your clients regularly, is capable of scheduling on short notice, willing to schedule on short notice because of this relationship. So I think in practice the relationship exists.
Does the client go to the lawyer first, or does the client go to the chiropractor first in this relationship?
Well, my understanding is, Justice Abrahamson, that there was about between 6 and 15 cases, Mr. Reitz testified that way, in any given year, referred one way or the other. If a client went to Dr. Daniels, Dr. Daniels may suggest, I know a good law firm that can handle your personal injury case, or if the client came to the Reitz-Mandelman firm, they would suggest that they make an appointment with Dr. Daniels for treatment. And again, I think that's the type of a relationship that is prevalent, at least that it's that way in my experience. Again,
Mr. Kent, I'd like to follow up with something, and it goes back to my original question, and then afterwards in response to a different question you said, it's stipulated that there was always oral notice from your client's firm to the chiropractor's office that the payments had been received, and I think that went to your argument that this was more a technical violation of the rule in regard to the written notice requirement. Is it stipulated that there was always, in each of these disputed 15 cases, oral notice from your client's office to the chiropractor that, hey, we received this payment?
That was uncontroverted testimony at the hearing, Justice Gableman, that Mr. Reitz testified that there were always an oral notification to Dr. Daniels from Mr. Mandelman that the matters had been settled. But there was, except in four cases, there was no written notification of the settlement, which is the first part of the rule. A lawyer gets the settlement, he's supposed to immediately inform, obviously, the client, and there's no dispute about whether or not the client was informed here of a settlement. But he's also supposed to immediately, or as close as possible in time, notify a third person in writing that he's received a settlement. And that's supposed to be in writing. The practice of this firm was that Mr. Mandelman, based on this long-term relationship with this doctor, did not do that in writing. He always had an oral conversation with Dr. Daniels and attempted to negotiate the fee that the client would pay basically tried to reduce the fee to Dr. Daniels in order to maximize the benefit to the client. And it was not done in writing, except in four occasions. There are actually four letters from Mandelman to Dr. Daniels. It's an appendix item. The back of respondent's brief, appellant's brief, I'm sorry. Appellant,
page.
Appellant 17, 18, 19. And then 21, the four different letters from Mandelman to Dr. Daniels or Daniels Chiropractic, basically informing him that they have settled the claim and asking for payment history and so on and so forth, as the court can see, as the justices can see. But again, there was no written notice, as is required by the statute. My experience also is that in most cases, as a lawyer settling a personal injury case, you would receive the payment and you would be writing a letter saying we've settled the case, and also enclosed is your check. It all happens in one letter. That did not happen in this case because of the nature of the relationship, in my opinion.
Counselor, is there anything in the record that would let us know whether these bills that were not satisfied in full were totally bills generated by the accident that was the subject of the lawsuit rather than by some other occasion which necessitated chiropractic services?
That is not clear at all.
So you don't know what the bills for the chiropractor were for, just that the client went there, but you don't know if they were limited to the accident for which Attorney Reitz was proceeding.
I don't know that. And I don't know, I do know it in the letters I was referring to. Mr. Mandelman always stated that he would like to have a complete, or he would like a payment history.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm assuming that he is trying to differentiate whether some of the charges were unrelated to the injury for which he was pursuing a claim, but it's not clear. And I don't think there's anything in the record about that, Justice Rogan said.
Thank you.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Pamela Galecki case?
The Galecki case. I am.
I think
some degree. There's a testimony about the Galecki.
You just pointed to the letter from Attorney Mandelman to Dr. Daniels on page 17 of your appendix.
Yes, Justice Prosser.
We have settled the case for substantially less than the case is worth due to some problems in litigation. They were offered $300, is that right?
That's apparently the case.
Was the settlement for $10,000?
I'm reviewing the transcript of the proceedings regarding Galecki, and I don't think that that was made part of the record, Justice Prosser, the amount of the settlement. Unfortunately, I believe it should have been, but I don't think that it was. So it's hard to determine what the matter was settled for. I don't see it in the record. All I can rely on is that Mr. Mandelman was saying it was settled for substantially less than the case is worth. I also am not clear on what the lien was on the Dulecki matter. I know that the testimony at the hearing was that Mr. Reitz had very little to do with the Dulecki matter. That was a case that was in Mandelman's office before Mr. Reitz joined the firm. And he may have written a check on the matter, but that would be the extent of Mr. Reitz's involvement in the Dulecki matter. And that's all I know about that.
You seem to be arguing that that Mr. Reitz ought not to be liable at all for a violation of the code. I mean, as I read your brief, you accept that there was a violation, accepted the referee's report as to the violations, and your argument, and you accept restitution, right?
Correct.
And you accept costs.
Correct.
So you're only argument is the extent to which sanction should be applied.
That's correct, Justice.
And that the referee recommended 4 months. And as I understand it, you think it should be 60 days.
Mr. Reitz asked for 60 days in his brief. We may be stuck with that, but I would ask the court to consider a private or public reprimand under the circumstances. In reviewing all the cases and in reviewing the facts here and the violations, I just don't think they're of such an egregious nature that a four-month penalty is called for.
In other words, if I can restate your argument, which may not be a fair restatement by the law, you don't think that failing to live up to an agreement with a chiropractor for payment of the chiropractor's fees out of the settlement is that important a deal that the attorney ought to be punished for failing, disciplined, I should say, for failing to live up to that deal?
That's not exactly correct.
No, I know it's not exactly. I mean, I'm giving it to you in very blatant terms. So you state it. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give you the opportunity to state it in less severe words.
I would say that these are not complete agreements because there's missing very important terms to the agreement. Namely, what is the charge going to be that I'm agreeing to pay? It was an open-ended agreement to say we would pay fees, but the fees necessarily had to be reasonable and necessary. As we know, healthcare provider charges have to be reasonable or necessary, or they're not. They wouldn't be ordered to be paid, for example, in a jury trial. So, in a sense, here there was clearly an agreement to pay fees. But the determination of fees was not made at the time when the agreement was entered into. And it makes it an odd type of a situation. But I don't think it's a complete contract at the time when they sign the lien, because they have no idea about the most important term of the agreement, in my estimation, is what is the charge I'm agreeing to pay.
Now, is that the typical or atypical way of doing the lien? Agreement.
Again, my experience is a healthcare provider would provide services to a client who would then have their health insurance carrier pay the healthcare provider, and so I would have a subrogated company who that I required I need to pay at the end at the settlement time, Justice Abramson. So I mean, there are situations, obviously, where their uninsured persons get medical treatment and have no way to pay the doctor, in which case, it may be a more typical situation to have a healthcare provider waiting for payment at the end. It's hard to say whether it's typical or atypical. I think both of these scenarios occur, and I do know that it's a regular practice in some areas to have a referral system to a doctor such as this one.
So you're a real defense then, I'll maybe overstate this too, is that your client was protecting his clients by just not automatically paying out to the doctor, to the chiropractor, but requiring that the chiropractor make proof and that the chiropractor not have recovered from someone else?
I believe that's accurate to a great degree, that you're protecting your client by making sure you only pay the chiropractor the monies he's entitled to. I think that's clearly protection for the client for the reasons stated. And I note that in four of the cases, the clients actually objected to payment to the chiropractor because in four cases, it's the Rousey, R-O-W-S-E-Y cases, and the Gonzalez case, the clients, it's Mr. Wright's testimony, it's in the record, that the clients objected to paying Dr. Daniels any more money. Because Dr. Daniels, in those cases, had been paid out a certain sum by their insurance company. So the clients actually objected to paying any more in fees to Dr. Daniels. And again, we have this inherent conflict in this system that if Mr. Wright's or Mr. Mandelman had paid money to Dr. Daniels, it would have been violating the agreement that Mr. Wrights or Mr. Mandelman had with the client. So it's a natural conflict.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. We'll give you 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The red light is on. That means I'm finished.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Robert G. Crone, counsel representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Robert Crone, retained counsel on behalf of OLR, and as in the past, it is again an honor to appear in front of your honors. this case involves one disciplinary complaint, 15 violations of former SCR 21.15B, and the referee determined that OLR had established the violations to the requisite degree of proof. I'm concerned about what appears to be some confusion about the facts. OLR's basic exhibits in this case are in a three-ring blue binder that were admitted in evidence by the referee, and I guess I would have assumed would have been transmitted with the record. Exhibit 1 are the actual lien documents. Exhibit 2 are the actual bills. And Exhibit 3 is the reconciliation statement from Mr. Wrights as to how he handled the settlements. Now, in answer to Justice Rogenstadt's questions, the Exhibit 1 doctor's lien is a form lien, and it is signed by Mr. Mandelman or Mr. Wrights, and for the most part, Mr. Mandelman, but at all times they're in a partnership. And Mr. Mandelman agreed that he, like Mr. Wrights agreed that he, like Mr. Mandelman, would be bound by these liens, so there's not an issue there. And the liens provide, and I quote, "I hereby authorize and direct you, my attorney," this is signed by the client, "to pay directly to said doctor such sums as may be due and owing him for medical services received by both, by reason of an accident and by reason of any other bills that are due this office." So the lien is very comprehensive. I'm not sure as an attorney I'd have anything to do with one of these liens signing it, but he did sign it, and it certainly would apply to the proceeds of the settlement. I would think Mr. Wrights, had he argued this point, could have said, "We'll honor your lien, but only as it relates to bills related to the accident in question." The point is that none of this was ever done. They signed the liens, and then the bills are here as well as Exhibit 2. Mr. Wrights had the settlement checks, had the bills, had the liens, And there was just never, in 15 instances, a clear effort, well, there was somewhat of an effort, but there was never a clear reconciliation of these liens and resolution of the liens.
So you don't have a problem with the fact that he may be proceeded upon by OLR because he didn't pay for bills that had nothing to do with the accident?
Well, I have a problem. I mean, if you extend this out, I would have a problem with that. That's really not the thrust of our position here. Our position is that Dr. Daniels has a lien to some extent, and it's arguably only related to bills related to the accident, and those amounts of bills should have been resolved. I think that's an argument that he could have taken. And what could he have done? Well, many things he could have done that he didn't do, but and he also acknowledged in the transcript that he signed the liens. Counsel here was not present at the disciplinary hearing, so I can understand why he wasn't aware of that. But the liens are in evidence, as are the bills. And as far as the Galecki matter, that was settled for $10,000, Justice Prosser. And I don't know to what extent that answers some of those unresolved questions.
You know, I guess what's kind of bothering me is every time a lawyer breaches a contract, it isn't a disciplinary matter. And so I assume that you proceeded against him because he received monies in trust for an injury that his client suffered. And if those monies were related solely to the matter for which he was hired, I guess I understand your position better than I do if the monies were to be used to pay his AT&T bill and an outstanding gasoline bill and anything else that was on the lien.
I appreciate that would be overreaching, and that's not our position.
No, and I understand it's not, and but it's giving me some trouble, frankly.
Right. The rule that we're talking about does require notification in writing. That wasn't done in any of these instances.
No, and I understand.
And he did send a notice in writing on four of them, but as the referee pointed out, that was hardly an effective notice. It simply talked about a settlement, didn't talk about the terms, didn't propose how to resolve it, and so forth. And then it talks about prompt delivery. Now, I would concede that perhaps Mr. The chiropractor might have been difficult, or he may have had difficulties with clients in terms of what they thought was fair, and what's the bottom line going to be as far as what the client gets. You want to satisfy your client. But you also got to take care of these liens. You just can't write letters, or you just can't ignore them. You just can't say, well, as he did here, we don't owe the liens because the comp carrier has disputed them. That may be true, but he didn't send that letter to the chiropractor or otherwise try to resolve those things. So you have a kind of a hodgepodge of results here. He sometimes sent amounts less than what was owing.
Just so I'm clear, is your concern that A, he didn't pay the chiropractor lien, or B, that he didn't give proper notice? I know part of it is the latter, because he didn't give notice when these monies came in. And if he did, the notices were not sufficient to fully inform the chiropractor. So I understand that. In regard to the payment part, is that part of the reason why OLR proceeded against him?
Yes, there should be some form of prompt delivery, or if that's impossible, there should be some sort of resolution, or if that's impossible, there should be some sort of effort to get the lien resolved. You just can't let the money languish in your account. You can't pay it over to your client. You probably should, and it's cumbersome, you probably should bundle these cases together with Dr. Daniels, go into a circuit court on a declaratory judgment, and say, Judge, we think we owe Dr. Daniels X amount, and Dr. Daniels should have notice, and he could come, and that could be resolved. That none of that was done. Now, I know that's cumbersome, but the problem is, if you don't do something like that, you have this mixture of results, like we have in this case, where clients are getting sued by Dr. Daniels down the road. In one instance, the restitution issue in this case, in one instance, Mr. Wright's paid an amount on Mr. Sergel that was greater than the lien amount, and that money was gone. And so you just have this crazy quilt of non-resolution of these problems, and that's why I think the rules important. And Mr. Reitz is no novice in this department. I mean, he's been practicing for a number of years. And I would agree that this does not rise to the level where he's stealing the money or there's any kind of fraud like that. But it is deceitful because there's a number of cases where this issue is just being ignored or swept under the rug. And now, after the fact, he's coming up with his answers. And the purpose of the rule, I think, is to avoid the kind of random, inconsistent ways of dealing with these liens as we have here.
And, well, Mr. Krohn, part of the purpose of the rule seems to provide the notice or the form of the notice. And what I understood Mr. Kent to indicate is that while written notice was not provided, there was always, in each of these cases, oral notice. And does that comport with your understanding of the rule?
No, it doesn't, because there was not, contrary to what counsel said, and he wasn't at the hearing, and there's nothing in the record of any kind of a stipulation that there was oral notice. In these instances, there was nothing in the record that substantiated oral notice on all of these. There was conversation that Mr. Reitz believed, Mr. Mandelman talked with the chiropractor. As I recall, there was an objection as to hearsay on that. And that whole issue of oral notice, and I would grant that the referee did not comment on that, but there was no agreement that oral notice was given to every instance.
I think his statement was not that there was an agreement that oral notice was given, but that there was uncontroverted testimony by Mr. Reitz that he gave oral notice every time. Is that incorrect as well?
That does not square with my memory of the testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Could I ask you, Mr. Krohn, I believe Mr. Kent said there were situations in which the chiropractor's lien exceeded the total settlement.
Yes.
Is that true in any of these 15 cases?
Well, I don't have any reason to doubt that. I think there was testimony from him that his clients claimed that the chiropractor overbilled the client and they shouldn't be satisfied out of the lien. And Mr. Reitz seemed to use that as a reason to not honor the liens. And he was listening to his client in some instances and didn't do anything about the liens. Well, the problem with that is that there is this third party, the chiropractor, who has by contract here, who has some kind of an interest here. And I don't think it's appropriate for a client to determine what the chiropractor gets on a lien. If that were the case, these lien holders would never get anything, probably, because that comes straight out of the client's pocket in terms of their settlement. But I think you do get into an unfortunate situation where you have an injured person who has probably more chiropractic care than one would expect or maybe even need, and the insurance company, the liability carrier, is going to pay an X amount of dollars that is not very much, and perhaps the client wants to accept that, but you got this big lien to deal with. And that's part of the business here, and part of the reason why, if that is a problem, you don't get into those situations, you don't take those cases, or if you do, and you have to deal with the lien, you go to a court and say the lien's unreasonable or the settlement is such that it's kind of a made whole kind of argument, although that made whole theory doesn't apply here, but it's a kind of an argument that you would make to a court that maybe this lien in total shouldn't be paid. But just to say the client doesn't want it paid, I'm not going to honor it, I'm not going to notify the chiropractor, it seems to me to be problematic.
Well, really, then, any time the client objects, the matter should just be taken to court because how can you solve that conflict of interest yourself, right? Because that would have been the resolution.
I can only draw from my own experience. When that happens, you try to work out a deal. You try to get the client to the chiropractor, and most times that works. And the chiropractor will take 50 cents on the dollar. You put it in writing, save that money, set it aside, pay it. At least in 35-plus years, I've never had a problem with that.
You represent your client,
yes,
negotiating with the chiropractor,
yes,
not the chiropractor.
Oh, yes, you represent the client.
You don't have an obligation to the chiropractor regarding full payment. You have an obligation of not releasing funds without giving the chiropractor an opportunity because the chiropractor has a lien.
Correct. You can't ignore the chiropractor, but your interests are, your client is your primary, your sole interest, and you do what you can for your client. And
I was just trying to make sure that you can do that negotiation and that there is no conflict of interest in doing that negotiation.
I wouldn't think so.
Of course, it's like any lien. You're not obligated to the lien holder, other than if you can't settle it, you got to protect the money.
That's right. That's my understanding.
Well, the fact that he signed these agreements, does that have any effect on it? So you've got the client signing it. You've got the attorney apparently signing it. And I'll go look at it, but I assume, you know, that that's what happened here. So they both signed it saying they would pay the chiropractor. So the attorney's got his own one-third or whatever he's operating on here, which may be impacted. And the client's got his or her one-third, and the chiropractor wants to get paid, which may be a half, 50% of what comes in. So you got really three parties that have an interest in that money, don't you?
You'd have, yeah, you just hope you have enough to go around.
Yeah, I can believe
the,
that.
What the attorney signed, it says the undersigned, being attorney of record for the above patient, does hereby agree to observe all the terms of the above and agreed to withhold such sums from any settlement, judgment, or verdict as may be necessary to adequately protect said doctor above named.
Mm-hmm. So it could impact on the attorney's payment of himself as well.
I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the sanction in this case is concerned,
let me, and you talk about as far as the sanction. As I understand it, the sanction is the only thing in issue here today. Am I right or wrong on that?
Well, you're
help
right,
me.
But the facts as set forth by counsel here, or his turn of the facts, his spin on the facts, it was important for me to, I think, point out that these things are all in the record, the liens and the bills and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think counsel was aware of that.
There's no contest, and I think the chief covered this earlier in questioning.
He has acknowledged that he violated the rule in 15 instances.
Okay. The only reason we're talking about all these facts is that assumed, and it's no question that there's a violation. The nature of the violation is, the question is whether that should affect the nature of the facts of this violation, whether those facts should affect the sanction. So if you paint a rosy picture of these facts, then you'd say that the sanction should be private or public reprimand, or 60 days, depending on your range. You would paint a different picture of these facts, still being a violation, but say 4 months.
Right. We're
and now you're going to paint the facts.
We're finish putting a different twist on the facts,
yeah.
The same facts.
Okay.
And so what's your twist? He's emphasizing the mitigating fact,
right.
And I'm emphasizing the others. And the others, this is an intentional act. It happened 15 times over a period of 5 years. I don't consider this a negligent act by ignoring these liens or doing what he said. I believe these are more than technical violations. Indeed, there is no deceit, there's no stealing, but the case law dealing with those kinds of cases typically involves 6 months or greater suspensions, and that's not what we're seeking here. And I'd be the first to admit that the cases, to try to determine or distinguish between those cases that support a 60-day suspension, those that support a 4-month suspension, I could be dancing on a pin trying to reconcile some of those cases. There's a very fine line between those two. I think it's a case that does require a short-term suspension.
So, Mr. Cohn, you do agree with Mr. Cantor that there was no deceit. And that's I haven't been too subtle in the nature of my questions of going to the prompt notification in writing versus the prompt disbursement of funds. And so it doesn't appear that your client's concern in this matter is that Mr. Reitz was trying to hide money. It goes more to the prompt disbursement. If you're agreeing with Mr. Kemp, there was no deceit, that seems to me to be your position.
Now, he's not trying to hide the money. I don't know really what, I mean, there could be several definitions of the word deceit, and I think there's an element of deceit here by just kind of remaining ignorant of the problem and dealing with the problem and notifying of the problem. I think there's an element of deceit there. But was he affirmatively hiding the money or taking the money? No. And for that reason, we don't feel that it's a case that warrants a significant suspension or more.
Counsel, when I look at the fact that he had a 5-month suspension previously, I did not pull that file, so I'm only surmising. 5 is an odd number for this court. So my guess is that maybe there was a request for 6 months, and that there was a request, and I've been making this up, I don't know this, and that there was a lower amount, and we came in at 5. Why not do the same thing here? You want 4, they want 2, come in at 3, which is an odd number too.
I don't know what your reasoning process would be, if that would be a
part of it. Oh, there's no reasoning process. That's just clearly splitting the difference.
I couldn't argue with your reasoning process.
Well, there's none, no reasoning, so you can't argue with a void, I guess.
Well, the reason for 5 instead of 6, or 4 instead of 6, is that there's a significant difference. Once you get to 6, of course, you've got to request a reinstatement, and that takes time and effort and perhaps money. So as soon as you get below 6, you've got only an issue of how long the lawyer is out, because then there's an admission, unless there's a problem, which we would hope would not happen.
Right, the 6 months is not what we're seeking here.
You're seeking 4.
Right. And the progressive, the idea of Justice Bradley of this progressive discipline, just if I can touch on that in my remaining time, I did handle the prior case, and I don't frankly remember how this court arrived at 5 or what the referee said and so forth, but I do know that the violations in the prior case were not of the same type as we have here, so we don't have a situation where Mr. Wright has repeated his prior disciplinary conduct.
Mm-hmm. But, a lot of it was neglect, I think, in the last.
But in point of time, these cases are fairly close in point of time, and our concern is that Mr. Wright has somewhat of a cavalier or perhaps indifferent attitude towards the rules that are being violated here. As I said before, he's not a rookie at this business, and this is 15 cases over a period of time. And he had, and their firm did have, I would describe as a fairly cozy relationship with this chiropractor that apparently has gone sour since, but there was a referral back and forth until it came down to the point of these liens. So
I see the aggravating factors here as you're dealing with 15 different clients. That's a large number. It's not one client.
Right.
I see an aggravating factor that he's had prior discipline. And prior discipline of 5 months. I understand the underlying discipline matters. Maybe, in fact, some of them I recall were of neglect nature. So they may be different. They are different than what we have here, but nevertheless, he's been the subject of prior discipline. I see those as two aggravating factors, the number of clients involved over a period of years, and his prior discipline. Is there any other aggravating factor?
Well, I think there's somewhat of an effort here in terms of Mr. Weiss's analysis of these facts to deflect responsibility from himself. There's an effort to, in part, deflect responsibility as a partner, Mr. Mandelman, but they at all times were a partnership. They were doing different types of work on behalf of these clients, and they benefited from the fees jointly, so there's joint responsibility here. I think that there is an effort to shed himself of some responsibility here by talking in terms of the chiropractor and how difficult he was to deal with. That may well have been the case, but I think that is an aggravating circumstance. But I don't see any others.
What about the lawsuits that were filed against some of the clients?
Oh, that, yes. Thank you. That is a circumstance, a kind of a spin-out here that happened. In some cases, these liens weren't resolved, and the chiropractor turned around and sued these clients. The inconvenience and the cost and the overall hassle to them. And then you have this complete misfire on Mr. Sergel, where you can't make up some of these facts. Apparently, some money is being paid to a collection agency. The collection agency absconds with some of the funds here. Mr. Sergel gets sued. Mr. Wright pays more than is actually owing. Sergal's got a judgment against him, and even though the amount's been paid, I don't know where that amount eventually ended. And that's what the referee said, well, that's a definable amount that should be the subject of restitution, the overpayment. And I agreed with him in terms of the standards this court has established to calculate restitution did apply there, and that's what he found. But that is an aggravating circumstance.
What about, didn't Mandelman and Reitz go into court seeking a declaratory judgment that all monies due the chiropractor were paid? Daniels didn't appear, default, I might have that wrong. What consequence is that declaratory judgment action? Well, on the issue of restitution or anything else here?
That after OLR's investigation started, in I believe three instances, a declaratory judgment action was started, and the details of that were never totally set forth in the record what happened there. But I understood that somehow or another a payment was made in the court and those were resolved. That was after the investigation, and that is frankly the kind of thing that should have been done along the way here, probably with all of them. That is, I think, in part a mitigating circumstance on behalf of Mr. Wright, that he did in those instances try to clean up those liens. But it was only after the investigation started and the liens had been ignored. I don't know if that answers your question.
Could I ask you, your opposing counsel talked about these are negligent acts.
Yes.
You say they're intentional acts.
Yes.
I don't want you to just kind of create an answer to this question, but based on the record, what is the motivation for what you describe as intentional acts?
I think they're intentional acts because he has the funds, he has the lien that he signed, he has the bills, he knows the chiropractor has something coming and doesn't do anything about it. That, to me, is intentional. Now, what is his motivation? His motivation was not to profit himself. His motivation may well have been to ultimately help his clients get, maybe he hoped that the chiropractor would back down or would send a letter or would the thing would pass somehow. So I can't speak to the motivation. I can say that because the money was not diverted to Mr. Wright's, his motivation was not to profit by this. That's without question.
Well, it would help. It would hinder him because he's biting the hand that feeds him. I mean, by taking on the chiropractor and not giving him money, he runs the risk that the chiropractor is not going to send him business.
That's one of the risks in having this kind of relationship, because you. And I'm not saying this happened here, but when you have a deal like that with a chiropractor and you have a lien, you may be sacrificing some payments that might otherwise go to your client to keep your chiropractor happy, who's going to feed you more business. And that's a problem that I don't know if Justice Crooks is alluding to that, but that's a potential here if you have this ongoing relationship. Because who's your loyalty to? The lines of loyalty could get very easily confused down the road. My orange light is on, but I've run out of things to say unless there are other questions.
Any other questions? We don't want to hold you. Thank you, Mr. Grohn. Mr. Kent.
I believe it is accurate when I said that it's uncontroverted that Mr. Wrights testified that there were oral negotiations in each and every case, and I would refer to page 85 and 86 of the transcript, beginning at line 20. The referee is questioning Mr. Wrights. He's already referred to the four cases where there was actual writings from Mandelman to Mr. Daniels. And the referee questions at line 20. With respect to the remaining 11 cases of these 15 identified in the complaint, no written notice then was given to Dr. Daniels at all. Is that right? Answer, that's correct. Question at line 25, why? He was contacted orally. That was never refuted by anyone, that an all these instances, other than the four instances where Mandelman actually made a writing, that Dr. Daniels was contacted orally. So I believe I was accurate in saying that's uncontroverted. I wanted to make a point about the relationship between Mr. Mandelman and Mr. Wrights and how that affects this. In my opinion, being partners, Mr. Mandelman and Mr. Wrights are clearly liable for the liabilities of the firm and would be liable, for example, if malpractice was committed by the firm. I have trouble with the idea that Mr. Wrights is automatically responsible for ethical violations that Mr. Mandelman made. And I think the record is complete with a number of ethical violations that Mr. Mandelman made that fall to Mr. Wrights as becoming a partner in these cases.
Are you contesting that there are violations of the code now?
I am not. As I stated...
By your client?
No, my client. Clearly, he stipulated to the fact that he did not provide any written notice in any of these matters.
And Mr. Kent, if Mr. Mandelman had signed the liens, and he signed most of them, and if Mr. Mandelman dealt with the clients, and if Mr. Mandelman then dealt with the chiropractor, and Mr. Mandelman had not paid off or given notice to the chiropractor, I'd have a hard time saying Mr. Wrights is not liable under the code. On the other hand, if partner one signs the lien, and partner two takes the case, and partner two deals with the case, and partner two has the file, and partner two sees the lien, it's hard for me to say that that's a mitigating factor that another partner signed the lien. Because we're not contesting the violation.
I'm saying it's a mitigating factor that in a great number of these cases, many of which were clients of the firm before Mr. Wrights even got there, that you don't know exactly what your partner is doing and vice versa.
Who dealt with Dr. Daniels?
Mandelman.
In all of these negotiations?
In all of the negotiations. That is the testimony, basically, that Mr. Wrights had extremely limited contact with Dr. Daniels.
Who dealt with the client?
Both of these gentlemen dealt with the clients. I believe the testimony is that Mr. Wrights had the main responsibility on two of the 15 files, the workers' compensation file.
The workers' compensation, yeah.
I believe the testimony is also that Mr. Wrights had limited responsibilities on the great majority of these files, in some instances simply writing checks at the end after Mr. Mandelman negotiated it, after Mr. Mandelman settled the cases. All that Mr. Wrights did in a number of the cases was draft the settlement document itself and issue the check.
Well, drafting the settlement document, you had to look and see what the liens were, didn't you?
Obviously. And I want to point out, too, that in every one of these instances, Mr. Wrights and Mr. Mandelman did try to negotiate out Dr. Daniels' fee. They did not just leave Dr. Daniels hanging.
Counsel, you say in every one of these instances, every one of these instances. Well, it's my understanding that in two of the client settlement matters, that those monies were received when Wrights was the sole owner of the firm.
He may have been the owner, but again, he was not the attorney responsible on these cases. And I think that's the more important point. Who is the responsible lawyer? To take the...
Help me with this. Because in the referee's in the referee's report and recommendation, the referee talks about the law firm. It's Appendix 6, counsel. Appendix 6, yes, thanks, Chief. And talks about initially they are equal partners. And then gives the date, I'm on Appendix 4 now, on November 1, Wrights acquired sole ownership of the firm. Was Mandelman still practicing with, they went from equal partners to Wrights was the sole owner But Mandelman was still there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And still responsible for the same files, Justice Bradley. And that's the point I'm making, that it would be extremely onerous for every single partner in a firm to know what every single other lawyer is doing and making them ethically responsible for every single act or lack or...
How many files did you have on each client in a law firm? I don't know. Maybe you have several. But typically there's one file for one client, typically. I don't know here. And typically, if you have a lien that was signed by either of the attorneys, and here we have both attorneys signing, although Mandelman more, typically that would be in a single file. Now, maybe that didn't happen here. Maybe you didn't put your liens in the client file. Maybe there were several client files. But assuming that you did put the lien in the client file and there was only one client file, wouldn't you hold the attorney responsible for its knowing what's in the file?
In some instances, I would agree with you, Justice Bradley. But in some firms, when you have multiple files, as a partner in that firm, I would have to necessarily go and check every file that my partner was working on, and vice versa. He would have to check every file that I was working on.
Incredulous to me. You have a file. You're about ready to settle. You got the check. You know, you've been working on the file. You don't take a look at the liens. You don't know what's in the file. Is that supposed to be okay?
He was not a lawyer working on the file. He just came in at the end. Mr. Mandelman would say, here's how it's been resolved, and Mr. Reitz would write the check.
But he had to look at to write the check. So
obviously,
he had to look at the file.
And in some
he had to look and see if there were any liens. He had to look and see if obligations were outstanding, right? When he wrote the checks. And I think that's Justice Bradley's point, isn't it? Sounds right, Chief.
And they did write checks to Dr. Daniels. I think in 9 out of 16 cases, they did write a check to Dr. Daniels, and there's no dispute. Dr. Daniels accepted checks. I think it's 9 out of 16 cases. A number went to the declaratory judgment, and a couple were the situation where the workers' comp insurance carrier had paid Dr. Daniels, and then there was a dispute about whether he was entitled to any more fees. So Dr. Daniels was paid in 9 out of the 16 cases. I think my red light's on.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Attorney Kent. Thank you, Attorney Cohn, for appearing, and thank you, Mr. Reitz, for appearing. These are, as you know, very difficult cases for the court, and that will end our hearing on 07-18-2935-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Jeffrey Reitz. The students should remain, and Justice Prossett will come out and talk with them, just so I can set the time for the court's conference. How much time do you want, Justice Prossett?
3 minutes.
Okay. We're going to make it a half hour, so it gives you time to walk back and forth. 11:30, the court will convene in the conference room.